This is our second meeting of Fine Art Photography Ottawa, a discussion group of fine art photography. And last week, Jim talked to us about scale in printmaking and photography. And we talked about things like that, where big landscapes get big prints, and also the many of the aspects of size in terms of producing and thinking about them. This week I want to talk about, not that side, but this side, where I've done some work in trying to assemble images from multi-points of view, and doesn't show there, occasionally multi-time, to put time and space into a single image. There's lots of different ways that multi-image gets used. You know, like I know Jim does focus stacking, or very interested in it. Have you been doing it?
A little bit, but not
yeah. And I know Ramon, I believe you've done panoramas.
Yeah.
Oh yeah, I ran across an old email with you, where I was asking you how you printed this very long thing.
Okay, yeah.
I think you did it into a Moebius strip.
Yeah.
Is that right?
Yeah.
Yeah. Went way beyond the size capability of AutoCAD by using a rip to print it, is what I understood. Yeah. I think AutoCAD has a 30,000 pixel limit, you said. I don't know if that still applies, but... So there's all these different ways of using multi-images, and I look at it, I find them just terribly interesting because they create much more interest than the single image. And when I ran across David Hockney and his talk about photography, it really resonated with me. I think he made a statement once about the one-eyed cyclops with a very short attention span, that is the normal image, taken through some distortion of lens, and how that just really didn't interest him. And he started assembling images when he had to do, he wanted to do a photograph for painting of a person, and he couldn't do it without distortion unless he did what he called a joiner. He took three images of a standing person, probably with something like a 50 millimeter lens, to get a normal undistorted view, or as much as he could, and just laid them over each other, and he used that to paint from. And later on, when he happened to have a number of cases of Polaroid film, he started playing around with that by, I think he first of all walked through his house and took multi-images as he went along, right through onto the patio, out into the garden, and stitched that all together. And it set him off for 2 years, basically. He barely did any painting for the next 2 years. He just explored this way of creating imagery by, he later on called it using the camera as a brush. So each image was a brush stroke. And he would assemble the brush strokes into essentially a painting for him. And his appreciation for pre-visualizing perspective for painting was applied to this new technique of assembling images. If you look through this book, you'll see a bunch of that. I think the book actually covers pretty well his early work in that, because that's Pear Blossom Highway on the front, and that was pretty well his last and best. He continues to do similar things with video. Like I know that there was an exhibition, I think, last year where video was produced on nine panels on a large wall, taken from a frame that he had fitted to a car, where each camera had a different, probably different apertures and distortions and different focus, and then the car travels down a laneway and you get all these things. Interestingly, the newest exhibit at Patrick McHale has something like that on water. This is more assembled and structured, in not in the way that he would do it, but it has a similar feel to it. There's one piece there by Cheryl Pegorick, I believe. So anyway, I got interested in that late last year, late 2011, and having a class in still life, started trying to do that kind of thing. And through it all, I did what I call 10 experiments, basically 10 shoots, mostly in a little studio in the corner of a bedroom, but also this one would have been done in the class. And just trying to see how this works out. And I got...
Could you just sort of...
Yeah, okay.
At least so we can get a small...
Okay.
What it is.
This one is very unlike the rest of them. It's I really like it for the warmth. We were doing trying to do Dutch lighting on a flower arrangement, and I was the assistant, so I was standing back with my out of focus camera, and I like mine well at least as much as the guy who was taking the still life. I went through a number of these things. Some of them I find very successful, and it's interesting why, you know, when they are successful, you know, what works. This one is up there. It's, to me, the dynamism of this that makes it so effective.
So how are you assembling that? How does the assembly of that differ from putting it into PT GUI and just doing a panorama stitch? I mean, It's clearly different.
Yeah.
I don't know how.
Well, it's the main difference is that I'm not standing in one place,
okay.
Covering.
Okay. So
I'm walking around. I'm going here. I'm going there. I'm going there. I'm giving different points of view.
And then you're hand assembling them with layers in Photoshop?
It might be. You can turn off the blending in Photomerge.
Okay.
So in some cases I'm doing that.
Okay.
So I let, if you see one like that, mm-hmm. with a distorted frame, mm-hmm. on each image,
yeah, that's what it was.
That was done by Photomerge.
Yes. Okay.
It's basically trying to make some sense out of these different points of view.
Yep.
And in some cases, it becomes a very strong graphic, you know, mm-hmm. like that.
So you just let it go?
I did, well, yeah, and then I reject it or accept it, you know. I mean, there's a lot of rejects there.
By a lot of rejects, are we talking one in 10, one in 100? How much playing around do you have to do to get something that you like in doing this?
Probably one in 10.
Okay, all right.
I'd say if you look in the book, the back of this book is sort of details the 10 different times I did a shoot and an assembly, different kinds of assembly,
yeah.
And you see all of the ones that were worthy of looking at there. Now that's not so. When I say 1 in 10, it's really probably 1 in 20.
Yeah.
The fact that you have certain, I'll call them frames that are lighter than others,
uh-huh.
something that came out of the shooting, came out of the process later, that you added deliberately, or what?
In many cases, that's there's probably no resizing of frames, but there is perhaps cropping of frames.
Yeah, I mean,
Is that what
so
you mean?
Some of the frames are dark and then others.
Right.
Just like, where did this show up in the process?
Where does the lightning show up? Or the different level of light?
Yeah, different level.
It's pretty well in the shoot.
In the shoot, okay.
Yeah. So they're probably all shot at the same settings. They're almost always all shot by hand, not on a tripod, because it's pretty well. I've tried it a little bit, and I can't get the kind of movement that I want. I suppose you could with a certain ceiling-mounted tripod or something, you know. But the lightning is just perhaps poor lighting, you might say. You know, what I'm doing now, actually, I'm going to start a whole new series now, and I'm going to try and light it in different ways. That was two lights. Usually two daylight compact fluorescence, although I had some other bits of lighting. So I'm going to try and light it. I really like what I'm trying to do is get the background to disappear a bit by lighting it properly, basically. And I'm going to play more with what I take to be Hockney's method, which is the building of an image. Trying to perhaps wrap the three-dimensionality onto the surface in different ways. So you come at the image, or you come at the object from the side, from the top, from the side, and bring that together in some way. I've also done a few other projects that trying to work with more dynamic situations. And this is my favorite so far. At Nuit Blanc, we had the exhibit for Festival X there when Nuit Blanc was on. And so Nuit Blanc opened at Orange Gallery where our show was. And I arranged with the artists there to take their photographs through the evening. And this is, what's her name, Lamb. Anyway, a drawer and her model. There's a number of her. And then a few of this woman, too, whose name I forget now. So this is more about time and things coming in over time.
Could you expand on that? Just say a bit more about
expand on
how that adds more time?
Well, it's taken over time, probably over a minute and a half or two.
So you shoot multiple shots.
Multiple shots of different portions of the frame.
Okay.
With people moving within it.
Okay. But each, but you're not blurring the individual shots there.
No. No.
Fairly crisply.
No.
You move your camera around?
Pardon?
You move your camera around?
Yes.
Can
right.
You show that?
Yeah.
So far away.
Yeah, just pass it around.
Have you got any sort of guidelines as to how much you can move your perspective before it starts becoming
out of
such that you can't really assemble it effectively, or is there any?
I don't think there is any, really. Depends on what you want to show.
So that's the three-dimensionality aspect you'd be changing all the way
to 360. Yeah. I remember Michael Tardioli asking me one time, because I was really playing with this kind of thing, with the assembled panoramas, and he had a problem. I forget who it was that was with him, but somebody wanted to take a picture of a cemetery with fairly inline headstones, and the only way you could get at it was from the other side of a fence. And he said, well, can you stitch that together? Well, no, you can't, in a way. I mean, you could walk along and take and treat it as though it were a flat wall with no depth, and you'd get some problems that way. But you could do this, and just don't bother trying to blend it. You know, like create an image of multi-images. I've done stitches like that of a flat, you know, like of graffiti on a big surface. And as long as it's flat, it works, because there's no depth. Right? Well, just treat it as though the depth didn't matter, in a sense. It's not going to be a real image. There's one here. I was rather tickled to come across some old... these were taken in about 1977. This dancer wanted portraits done, wanted pictures that she could use in her work. And so I've gone back to them and sort of assembled the sequence that happened at the time. This one's particularly engaging. And there's something missing here. Oh, maybe it's that. And then this is from a shoot in 2011, where I was trying to document a yoga teacher. And so she's moving through these, through the poses. But it's not just another way of using multi-images.
Yeah, it merges with pure panorama in one dimension.
Yeah, right.
With sort of strobe-type shot, repeated shots of people doing things or whatever.
Right,
yeah. Or whatever.
Yeah.
Yeah,
this is more of the strobe type.
Yeah, but then you can extend both of those into realms that they're not normally taken.
Yes. Yes. Yeah.
Yeah. That last one reminds me of Duchamp's New Descending a Staircase. I'd already been thinking about cubism and, you know, castles, different versions of things, for example, in Guernica. And I think the cubists were influenced by photography. Is this a case now where painting has now come around and has re-influenced photography? And
well, certainly through Hockney's work, I would say, although it doesn't get taken up much. You know, sure, it influences, except that who uses it?
Are there different, I don't know much about cubism, but were there different goals versus what you're doing now?
I think the goal would be the same. The goal would be to present reality in a new way. And I think that's what they were doing. That's what it looks like. Well, I did, except that any particular montage is probably a continuous set. There might be a few missing where there was more than I needed.
Okay.
But it's not assembled from a number of sets.
No, I understand that. So I don't know, take any like this one. How many did you leave aside sort of thing?
Oh, no more than three.
No more than three. Okay.
You know, it's just very occasionally.
Okay, but what about like this one, for example?
I'm
leading to somewhere, which is
okay.
How you make a selection and how you end up with creating because you probably, from this, there's maybe 100 different pictures you can make out of the original set.
Yes, right.
And how do you get to this one as opposed to another one?
So let me just say about this one, this is not a finished product in any way. It's particularly unsuccessful, I think. It's the only thing I've done out of 700 frames that I shot.
Okay.
And I have yet to do the work. Okay. So your question is very appropriate there.
So,
because
so if you have like 20 frames and you use 18, it's something. If you use 700 frames and you use 20, then it's a whole different problem, right? That's what I understand.
Yes.
The selection issue is much more present.
Well, it's not quite the 720. I'm just saying that I haven't done the work yet. This is perhaps 30 out of perhaps 40 at the same time.
Okay, so you made a selection of 30 out of 40, which leaves plenty of room to make many, many different pictures.
It does. It does. It does. Yeah, yeah. So yeah.
40.
So then, to me, the art is in your eye.
Okay.
Right. I mean, it's created a process where you have to go in at the end and do a whole lot of work, and that work creates the art. And it's so it's not done in the camera at the moment. And I like that process.
Do you pre-visualize what an image might look like before you start taking? Because if you're only doing, for example, you're shooting 20 shots and then you're able to use 18.
Yeah.
To me, that's a pretty good success rate.
Yeah.
Do you then sort of have an idea how you want it to go, or you basically, 18 is all you need for an image like that, and you work with those ones, and that's it?
Well, certainly through the process of 10 different shoots for these, I did. This is pretty well the last. This is the 10th. And the idea here was to assemble that graphic. It's the edges that become important. And actually, if you go to Michael Guinness Gallery after tomorrow, you'll see a few of these on the wall. That one. And the white paper is cut away, which strengthens the image just so much. And actually, this one's there, too. And it becomes a different thing. So that was shot for the graphic edge. And towards the end there, I did a lot of that. I kept trying to do it. That's a successful one to me.
Just a technique point. So you're saying that you, Scott, I remember you discussing you're thinking of trying to go this route, cutting the white paper away.
Right.
But you're mounting it on?
Yeah, so mounting it on, what's it called?
Dibond?
It's like that. It's an aluminum panel.
Yeah, okay.
Aluminum sandwich.
So you're cutting the aluminum panel to quite an intricate shape. Who did you have do that?
Display lamination. They're doing a very good job of the cutting. We're still talking about some of the other finishing aspects, but the cutting has been perfect. Now go to Michael Guinness and take a look.
No, I.
It's just stunning. The last one he printed. It's been used that way.
Somehow lose its. Done that one that way too.
Okay. That one?
Yeah.
No. He just wanted a few to start, and. We'll see where things go. I mean, you know what's happening there.
Why did you get on the idea of trimming them?
It was partly Michael, and it was partly I've always appreciated the edge. I mean, the edge becomes a strong graphic. So you were asking about the sizing of the individual frames. That's why they change sometimes, so that I can make the edge stronger.
Well, I think also it's sort of a continuation of your original principle or perspective, where you said you're trying to move away from a single viewpoint.
Yes.
A single viewpoint brings us back to a screen and a rectangle and a camera obscura or whatever.
Yeah.
Moving away from that, even in the shape of the finished product.
Yes.
It's not a rectangle anymore.
No.
It cannot be a screen.
Right. Right.
And it cannot be a window.
Yeah.
Windows never
right.
have this shape.
No.
They have the rectangular yeah. shape.
Maybe they should
so,
be.
So to me, it's a logical step
yeah.
from your starting point.
Right. So the next thing would be to create the window with such shape.
Or print on glass.
That, I mean, it sounds like fun to me. I don't
know. Have you thought of printing on glass?
No, I haven't tried it, but I haven't thought of it. I understand from display lamination that there's processes for printing on plastic now that are quite good.
You can
I
get
mean,
a clear
photo. They're printing on everything.
Yeah.
They have they have white ink now.
White ink. Okay.
Usually you don't need white ink because it's
no.
the white of the paper.
You have the paper,
white,
yeah.
The white of now.
Yeah, yeah.
White
you would need
ink,
it.
So you can print on anything.
Right.
Jake, I guess you wouldn't frame a picture like that with a traditional frame because that seems to be the whole purpose, which is kind of expanding out rather than containing.
Yes.
The frame contains things. And
yes.
It emphasizes various tensions within that.
Yeah.
Whereas what you're doing here is you're expanding outward, and that's really very, revolutionary, I would say.
Yeah, yeah.
A whole different thinking.
It's good. I mean, painters have...
Here, but it just changes the whole idea of it, right?
Right, right. Painters have done it by putting bits of frame together, or bits of canvas together, right? Like smaller frames... You know, basically framing an odd shape or stretching an odd shape, however they did it. I've seen that done a few times, actually, Hockney. I mean, Hockney is such an interesting guy. And I think it's mostly because he talks a lot. You know, most painters don't have a lot to say about what they do. He gets interviewed constantly, it seems. There's I don't know, a dozen books probably, an interview and stuff. And he thinks about interesting stuff.
I think there's something interesting about the framing. I would venture to say two things about the framing. First of all, framing, I believe, appeared at the Renaissance, at a point when painters started to think about painting with windows, the better description of windows.
Uh-huh.
So in the Middle Ages, there was no frame.
Right.
You had, there were sort of things on the wall, things were covering whole walls,
yeah.
things were, you know, artworks were part of windows, ceilings, there's no framing. Okay, so
yeah.
framing happened historically at one point in time, more or less to the Renaissance, which developed a single point of view going back to the original point.
Right.
But a single point of view, so the
yep.
frame is a window.
Yeah.
Going back to this,
yep.
the frame is a window. So when you throw away the window part, got to throw away the frame part as well, right?
Okay.
You throw away the single point of view.
Yeah.
And
yep.
we're better. I'm repeating what I said in a sense,
right?
Right.
Yeah.
From another perspective, you were throwing away the window and you're throwing away the frame. So there's a logical progression.
Right.
And also, the other thing you're throwing away is the glass. So what's the purpose of a glass in something like this?
Uh-huh.
It's protection. There's no other role to the glass than
right.
being protection.
Yeah.
Now, you need to protect ink on paper. Well, do you need to protect ink on dye bond? Do you need to protect ink on vinyl? Do you need to protect ink on whatever?
Yeah.
No.
Yeah.
You go, you look at the specs, and you have a 200 years life expectancy before degradation on these things. They don't need windows.
Yeah.
So they don't need, sorry, they don't need glass.
Okay.
So if you look at this, you don't need glass. You don't need a frame.
And I don't need paper either.
And you don't need paper. No.
like in that dye bond.
When you push your logic.
Yeah, yeah. No, you're right.
Well,
yep.
The question about aesthetics, then, in terms of composition, is what is composition now?
Right.
It's always been in relation to a frame. So
yeah.
Is there no such thing as competition?
Well, it's just more dynamic.
Or?
You know, if you put an image into a square frame, then the sides are balanced, and there's a lot more sort of dynamic necessary and possible within the image. I feel like the rectangle tends to draw things a certain way, whether it's vertical or horizontal, where if you go in a square, there's more dynamic. Well, this is just, I'm not saying this is the same thing, but that the dynamics are different. It's always the dynamic. And it has been in relation to the frame. This is in relation to the space around. Cut away the extra paper, and now where is it?
So the dynamic is sort of equal all around from the center moving out, as opposed to unbalanced, where in rectangular frame, you have different types of tensions on the sides versus the top, whereas here it's equal.
More all around, more like the square to me.
But is that composition at all?
Composition?
Any tension at all?
Yeah, actually, I'd say that just as panoramas have totally different compositional rules, like the rule of thirds and so on, doesn't apply to many panoramas. It's more have something at the beginning, have something at the other end, and the eye gets drawn through. So it works in a different way very often. And you, especially big panoramas, because then you view them close up and you walk through them more. But this, it seems to me, when I look at that one, for example, part of the reason that I like that so much is that the edge of the slightly gray-white, the frame of the picture, individual pictures,
right.
and the sort of shape it traces. And so this is something that I think there's definitely pleasing forms and placement of the flowers within the overall shape, but it's a combination of the placement of the flowers, traditional composition, and the shape itself of the individual frames.
So the composition is much more complicated.
So I would expect that there's definitely composition, but I don't think it observes for something that, which is sort of panorama, like, but it doesn't observe panorama, strict panorama rules of composition, so-called rules of composition either. This is something different to me, again. And it reminds me a bit of, if you look, I was thinking of Raymond's panoramas, which wrapped them around different geometrical shapes, such as Moebius strips. And again, the rules of composition.
Yeah.
I mean, I don't know what they are when we start doing geometrical figures. So
I have a question then, and that's what kind of an art form is this? Like, it's not conceptual in the sense of social or personal dynamics.
It's aesthetic experimentation.
Okay. And it's not portrait. It's not whatever. What is it? I it's perceptual somewhat.
It's the guy who wrote the book. I forget whether I read the French translation or whether the original was in English, but it was basically, his name is Barboza, and I forget the first name. And basically, his claim, this book was written in the 90s, maybe towards the end of the 90s. And basically, his claim was that photography representing what we know photography as representing a translation of reality, a capture of reality, was that. In fact, the title of the book was the Index Parenthesis.
Index Parenthesis.
Yeah, this is my translation.
Okay.
Which means that during 150 years, let's say roughly from 1850 to 2000, whatever, this was just in art. This is his thesis, right? Not necessarily mine. In the arts, this was a set point in the arts, part of art history, which this thing was important, and now it's over, very extreme point of view. And basically, and I think, you see, when the digital photography came about, we all asked ourselves this question, well, what is photography? Should we allow this kind of picture in a photo contest or not, blah, 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 blah. This is all behind us, right? And Now, my opinion is that in 2013, anything goes in photography. Anything goes. Why should we get stuck with certain principles? A photojournalist has a code of ethics, and we've seen that, where he cannot add and delete things because he has a certain role to play in society as a journalist. He's a photojournalist. He's a journalist. So he has a relationship to truth. But when you're a, quote, artistic photographer, you owe nothing to truth. You can do whatever you want. And yes, this creates a whole mushy, wow, mushy, what a bad word. This creates a whole area between, let's say, photojournalism, put it as an extreme, and other forms of art, which is more creative or whatever. And then we're now on a continuum where it's up to anyone to decide where do I want to be on this continuum at a certain point in time. Mm-hmm. You made a choice, and obviously this is a mix, right? You didn't hold a brush and you didn't put your brush and pigments to do this.
No.
But at the same time, it's not the truth in the sense of photojournalism truth.
Right.
Let me just respond to that, because that's very interesting. And I just finished teaching an undergraduate documentary course at Concordia, and the students were thrilled with the fact that truth can be challenged now, and that a documentary can be pretty well anything. And as distinct from journalism, who do have this connection to the truth, that's not the case with documentary films anymore. You can make personal films, home movies, whatever. That you're a documentarian if you call yourself that. So I'd like to ask Jake, you call yourself a photographer. If you were to submit this work, you would submit it, let's say, for a grant or something, in some kind of photographic category. So you call yourself a photographer. Why?
Because I use the tools. I mean, even if I twist them around a bit.
What's the
camera, the camera, the software, the lighting, the lens. Make decisions. I make photographic decisions.
You define it by the tools.
Yeah. Well, it's an assembled image. Is it still a photograph?
It's a print.
It's a print. Yeah.
Well, it's still a photograph, and somebody mentioned that maybe it's not true. I don't see that. Why is this not true?
Well, I don't think that matters. No, I agree. But it winds up as a print. It starts as a photograph, but a graphic of a printmaker will wind up with a print, but they didn't start with a camera.
Right.
I think the tool, this is interesting. I think the tool is a red herring here, because you define the tool, you defined the 2013 tool set.
Yeah.
You did not define the 1993 tool set.
Yeah.
Because in 1993 you had camera and film. Now you have camera and Photoshop, say.
But he could have done that quite as easily with traditional...
Not quite easily.
Not easy, okay,
you
not easily.
Done
you
done
could
it.
Have done it with traditional...
Okay, you
but a painter is still
it.
An artist, and a photographer, in his case, could also be an artist.
Yeah, you could have done it, but not so easily. And I think, I don't know, I'm not too sure, but I think defining this with the tool, according to the tool, to me is problematic, because going back to your point, if you take a hyper-realist painting, now take a magnifier. You have to take a magnifier to decide whether this thing you have in front of you is a hyper-realist painting or a photograph. It's very difficult to
do. And the opposite is true as well.
Yeah.
In some cases.
That's right. Yet this was done with pigments and brushes.
And
they
the
can
painter
be
would not call himself
amazingly photographic.
He called himself a painter.
They called themselves
so
painters.
I think it really has to do, perhaps, with what you think you are yourself, regardless of what tools you use or what it winds up looking like.
Yep.
If you call yourself a photographer or you call yourself a painter, you feel something very different there. I'm not sure what it is. But
yeah. Yeah, but this does sort of or start to blend the two. At least I feel that way from coming from Hockney, where he started using a camera as a paintbrush, basically. That's the way he described it. Not that I can do what he did, but it's an interesting exploration that way. You know. But yeah, I identify as a photographer.
Compositional terms, like a photograph as a paintbrush, like it's compositional, it's not technique, right? Like he's defining himself as a painter with a photograph solely on compositional elements. I mean, like, where do photographs lie that look like paintings? Someone else, I was walking through the market last night,
yeah,
and they're selling photographs that look like paintings. So where does this lie?
Like that one there. This looks like a painting.
Well, yeah, but there's like certain photographs that look exactly like oil paintings.
Uh-huh.
The photographers purposely make photographs that look exactly like oil paintings. Why?
And then there was the early photographs, the gun prints, where they tried to disguise the photo. The early, when was this? The 1890s? The gun prints, where they tried to make the photographs look like art, like paintings, because the realism wasn't, photography wasn't taken as a serious art form. So they tried to disguise them.
Pictorialists.
Yeah.
I don't know, maybe it is a tool. It makes a difference.
I don't know. I mean, just because everything I've done before has been more straight photography. So, must be a photographer, right?
This question of influence of photography or painting on photography is one that's interested me for quite a while, because it's a very well-established history of influence of photography on painting.
Yes.
You know, the camera obscura was originally a painter's tool and so on.
Right.
Your mention of Hockney brings to mind, I was just saying to Jim de Rivière that when I came in, that I had been watching a program just recently on TVO on Vermeer. It's called Searching for Vermeer, the great portrait photographer, painter. And this show consisted of about eight to ten individual people talking about how they were interpreting and using the influence of Vermeer in their work, current work, not playing like those bands that play in the style of not that sort of thing, but just in terms of how they were being influenced in their contemporary current work.
Mm-hmm.
And six or eight of these people were photographers, and they were showing how they were using the perspective, some of the perspectives, and as the one man said, what he was trying to capture, and he showed his pictures, and they were unmistakably capturing an essence of Vermeer. What he was trying to capture was the stillness of Vermeer, and he noted the difference between much of photography being snapshot, which is grabbing a moment in time. Whereas he said, Vermeer, what he does is he captured, you can almost sense the time passing because it's taking a picture of a mundane action, a woman sewing or whatever, something that takes a long time, and there's a stillness to the picture that seems to capture that duration of time, and you can almost picture that making the picture took a long time. Anyway, so there's that influence going on now. Painters, you know, that's another example, I guess, is what I'm saying. It's reverse influence, I suspect, the reason I've been growingly interested in this, is that I think that there's, for the first time really, the possibility for photographers to do artistically what, you know, we've got the degree of control now with our tools. It would have been very, very difficult to make that sort of montage without Photoshop and all of these sorts of tools.
Mm-hmm.
Now we have them, and now we can sort of get the influence going the other way.
Right. I also look at the work of Jerry Uelsman, who is a phenomenal darkman
Yeah.
person. and he would be able to do this type of stuff in his sleep compared to me. So I don't know if whether you're using traditional or Photoshop or whatnot is as important as the overall, you know, that is the image and that's how you display it.
No, it's just harder to do it.
Yes, absolutely.
People can do islands floating in the sky and
much
more.
Yes.
Like, could you produce a distorted frame with, say, a tilt shift onto a larger piece of film than the coverage? No. Yeah. The cover, no. You'd get vignetting and that stuff. I don't think you could. I don't think you could produce the individual frame in film. Could you?
Well, in the print, you know,
print,
just do
mold in the
dark
print.
Room.
Okay.
In the dark room.
In the dark
room.
Tilt the paper.
Yeah.
Okay. Yeah.
Just be deliciously hard.
Well, the digital tools certainly do make it doable.
Yeah, so now we're being judged more by our artistic sensibility and our eye. Because we're now judged, can be judged, by the same criteria, in a sense, as visual artists, painters, and so on, judged for hundreds of years.
Yeah, so when you take 60 or 70 individual images and you put them together in all the various ways that you might, it's your eye and your decision that creates the piece, and it has whatever positive or negative attributes that you put into it, rather than the.
Another manifestation of this, actually, of this sort of great mashup that's going on, is you know, printing on canvas, which is abhorred by many photographers,
right?
Photographers,
right?
But that melds that sort of confuses again this boundary.
Uh-huh.
And the other thing that's going on is that with these, again, Photoshop techniques, I find myself, you can reduce the dynamic range. In fact, to do really nice landscape prints, typically you will reduce the dynamic range of highlights and so on, to get the richness of color and so on in them, in a way that produces something that, in terms of the histogram and dynamic range, looks much more like paintings. If you look at painting histogram and so on, there, it's much more similar to that than traditional landscape prints, photographic prints.
Uh-huh.
So even the standard techniques that we're starting to use sort of are trying to get some of the things that photographers have had for many years, some of the knowledge, if you will, that they've imparted. Anyway, in my opinion.
So where are you going next?
Well, that dancer in the pines there is something I need to work on. And otherwise, I'm shooting with better lighting. I'm going to try some more of these with better lighting, more controllable lighting, because I only had two lights before, now I'm going to have six.
What type of light?
Compact fluorescent daylight.
Nothing special then.
Nothing special. I mean, just make sure they're daylight. Like, what's that? 5,500, 6,000 Kelvin, something like that. I just find it easier to work with that light. I mean, the fluorescent has a little bit of a green tint to it, no matter. You got to deal with that, but having the I like that light.
Even the so-called daylight, they have the green tint.
Say what?
Even the so-called daylight, you still have the green tint.
Yeah.
Yeah.
There's something about the fluorescent process. I don't know what it is.
Well, they've got huge spikes in the yellow greens.
Okay.
The power, spectral power distribution of fluorescent lights is hugely discontinuous, and just as it's not a nice thing.
Yeah. Yeah. No. No. And
LED lights are also not nice, by the way, in general.
E-light.
I've been told.
Diode or
LED.
LED. Yeah.
They're not. They're again discontinuous in ways that natural light isn't. Sunlight.
So So you're thinking of moving to portraits?
Well, yeah, a little bit. I mean, it's difficult to do. Like, I really like the ones from Louis Blanc, and even though, I mean, it's not. I like the dynamism of them, and I'd like to pursue that.
I like the one you said was not finished.
Yeah. Oh, the dancer.
Yeah.
There's something there.
The last one you showed, you said it's just write something.
Yeah.
I think there's something there.
Yeah. I need to spend a whole lot of time on that stuff because I just haven't had the time. I shot it in July and I still haven't had the time. There's three different settings. This was done at Rockcliffe in the where the.
I meant another one. I was talking about another one.
No? Oh.
This one.
Yeah, that's what I'm talking about.
Okay, yeah. Okay.
Yeah, so that's at Rockcliffe Park, and the picnic pavilion is right over here. And so there's two settings in the pavilion and the one with the pines behind. And then that particular set was done with me at ground level.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
So there's like seven or eight other setups, really, in terms of that I have to go through. And I just did it because I was excited that day, and that was like 3 hours, you know? But I just haven't gotten back to them.
Did it start somewhere, right?
Yeah.
Jake, I think you've done something. Okay, looking at your images here, which are they're beautiful.
Right.
But then following along with someone else's comment before, not to diss your images here, but I, in some ways, when I sort of look over, I see that as being indistinguishable from the window that's above it.
Uh-huh.
Same proportions, same pattern, backwards, inside out, white, black. And then my eye kind of goes around the room here, and like almost every other room, it's all very linear. It's all put together in that way in which we design our lives, and, you know, maybe since goodness knows when, in terms of how we order things, or metaphor of window, or whatever.
They're easier to build.
Certainly. Well, they're easier to build with certain materials. They're not easier to build with other kinds of materials.
Okay.
Cultures, then there are other materials that are used, and then lines won't work at all. So it's also, I think, partly the materials and a certain way of ordering things, which then replicates itself. Whatever. That would be a really neat discussion to have. And what strikes me, particular sitting over here, but looking over at that image right there, which I think is my favorite of these ones, is that, well, for one, it doesn't quite fit in a way. But what it does, though, is it actually does more. It's not so much that it doesn't fit, it's more that the room doesn't fit around it.
Wow.
So it's projecting something else into the space. I don't know what you've done here and piecing it together, the different perspectives. Cubist, I don't know. I don't know precisely, but there is something. So you're projecting something with that back into the space that sort of sets some questions, I think, around the space and linearity of our common spaces here, or in a linearity in which your otherwise very beautiful work, though, has been framed.
Mm-hmm.
And that's really. It's you're putting pressure back into this space here because in some ways I think you're undermining
whether
you're setting a number of other things on their head by doing this into question a number of assumptions that are here. But in fact it brings into it sheds some light on what some of the assumptions are here that are completely implicit that we just take for granted that we never even think of and question ever, period, because they are so common, and yet there's no reason for them to be this way.
they are just the way they are, but until you see them differently, and it's something like your piece over there actually does something to get one to think that. And congratulations, that's fantastic.
It pushes the viewer to I really like how you created the imaging the way it is, either with or around it, which again, I'm not sure wonderfully talented and knowledgeable people, but for me, just as a viewer, I'd be interested to see also if without the border. I think that in itself of seeing how you've done the edges, I really like that as well.
So to see it cut out, you mean?
Yeah.
Cut out of the white,
looking at it, just, I mean, now it's twice that I've been here, and each time I find it, first and foremost, I don't really see anything else except it when I'm looking at it. And I just find that I'm looking at the edging, I'm looking at the white, and then it's like he was saying, for me, I'll just simply put the pushes.
That's really interesting. I mean, I think of, okay, how do you display these things? And so what kind of a space would be best?
Exactly. And just like he was saying, because there's no frame around it, you are looking for the frame. There is no frame, so you're kind of expanding out. We're looking, so the top of the ceiling, here's the top of the frame there. The door, here's the left frame there. There's the woodwork above that bench. Because it has no frame, you have to
find it.
It really incorporates the environment where you set it up. One of the things that I was doing in this series was finding murals painted on the sides of buildings,
right,
in these little towns everywhere. But then, the tourist office will sell the postcards just of the murals. Mm-hmm. But what I found interesting was stepping back and seeing what was around them. and this one here, I'll pass it around. This is in London, Ontario.
Right.
And it's just walking along, and this is in the side of a garage. But there's garbage cans and other things around. It's a mountain landscape.
Yeah.
And
stuck down here.
I call it room with a view because there's a kind of a room there.
May I also
just a disposable camera?
What you were saying in the sense of how you're looking for, but then it almost pushes you back into the picture. It brings you back in to focus more in. That's what I love about it.
I missed the first thing you said there.
In the sense of trying to look for the
because it doesn't sit here.
The frame
pushes you back in.
I actually want to walk around behind it. Because to me, it's got almost like a translucent the way you've got your background. And also maybe because of the color of the wall behind it, it almost has that translucent feel. So that's why I was wondering about printing on glass or some sort of clear, so that you can walk around behind it and get that other perspective. Because here you are again, challenging space. You challenge time. But you've also managed to challenge space quite effectively as well.
That's a good idea.
You're going to walk around? we're supposed to leave sometime. No,
not yet.
But they have locked the door. Thinking about that, do we want to do this again? And if so, who would like to organize?
Disposable cameras.
I will at one point, but I'm not ready for 2 months.
Okay. I mean, I'm happy to help. I just don't want to be stuck at the middle of it, because I don't think it's a healthy thing. But I'm happy to help. I've got.
May I suggest
the boss man?
No, I don't want to be a boss.
You're the boss man.
I'd like to say how good a job you're doing.
Yes, that's right.
Okay. Thank you. You want to organize the next one?
Sure.
You want to talk?
So how far apart are these?
How far apart are these?
I don't know. A month? Could be more, but...
What do we put one?
I'd say a month.
2 months.
One month.
I'm sorry.
2 months.
A month is great. Yeah.
Yeah. And it's always on a Monday?
No.
Last one was
a Wednesday.
Monday.
I changed it tonight because Rick couldn't come on Wednesday.
Any night we have to serve.
Well, there's I don't know if I can find it here, but they have an online schedule, and people sign up for the nights, and.
Maybe Mondays there's not much competition. We might be able to get the
points. And hours run longer also, don't they, on Wednesdays?
They run longer on Wednesday, but he said they're willing to keep it open till 9 on Monday. Monday, Tuesday is the short hours. It tends to be Thursday, Friday, Saturday, and maybe even Sunday are just booked for music, or other things. Tuesday, I noticed, is pretty well booked in the next few months. I forget why. So it's been Monday, Wednesday. And there's many of them are open. We're open.
I'm in Montreal every Wednesday, but of course it's not up to me.
Somebody's going to miss every night.
Wednesdays?
I'm in Montreal every Wednesday.
You'll be Monday, I guess.
Yeah.
Is it? Anybody has problems with
Monday?
Yes.
No.
Monday is fine. So let's go for Monday.
Okay, good.
If we keep money, then this gentleman can give a presentation on visual documentary.
I promise I will.
That'd be fun.
I'll do one.
That's the fact.
I'll wait my turn.
And do the next one, the one after then.
So I don't know if you'll be talking about it at all.
I'll be talking about my latest work, which is... pictures I've taken through a webcam. Hmm.
Through a?
A webcam.
Oh, okay.
Public webcam.
If you haven't seen some of Sherman's exhibitions, some of the things that he's been interested in, I shouldn't speak for him, but has been public spaces. And so some of the panoramas have been of airports and so on, large public spaces.
Yeah. Mondays are open except for
through webcam.
Okay.
So the first
public drive.
So this webcam. The reason I raised that is
I forget how you do it. I just sent an email to
his computer,
Jeff at Press, but it's probably something like that.
I don't know what the webcams be. Would the webcams belong to the public space where the pictures were taken, or just your own?
It's a public. It's a webcam accessible to anybody on the planet.
Almost like surveillance?
No, it's just a public question. It's not surveillance at all. It's just one of those, I don't know who sponsors it.
Google,
I have no
probably.
Idea who sponsors that webinar.
We'll find out.
You'll find out.
Uh-huh.
Yeah, he's doing it. Four or 5 weeks from now, something like that.
Perfect.
Okay.
Good. So this is your mailing list, and I'll just send a notice. That's
okay.
The mailing list that you use.
So I've been doing two things. Anybody who has expressed an interest, even if they haven't shown up, I keep on the mailing list. I'm like, somebody's in France, somebody's in BC, whatever.
Yeah.
And
so
and
I
then
got one and only one email about this just today or yesterday.
Well, you weren't on the list. Until I remembered, Jim's not on the list. So, sorry about that. I mean, it made no sense that you weren't there, but I just, I'm human. And then the other thing I've done is I've made an announcement in ArtsList. So that's how. Sorry, I forgot your name.
Peter.
That's how Peter got here. And I would think, occasionally somebody will show up who hasn't been here.
That's good. I'll do a copy and paste of your notes.
Okay.
7 o'clock start time.
Mm-hmm. And I'd say set the date as soon as you can.
Yeah.
And we'll announce that, but then have a reminder right near the end.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
for coming. This was fun. And this is what I meant to say.